morning, Sue, and good morning to all our listeners out there. Welcome back to the Academia Horse Friends podcast. My name is Selina Skogan, and today our guest is Sue Dyson. And Sue has a magnificent career in equine veterinarian medicine. Orthopedics is her specialty, and she is also very renowned as a pain researcher in the field of equestrian medicine. I'm always a little bit nervous when I have people like this sitting here on the other side of Zoom. But first, let me say welcome, Sue. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, and please don't feel nervous. I'm a very ordinary person.
Yeah, but you know, you are one of the persons who has shaped my insights into the equestrian world very much. Was always very impressed since the first day I met you by your passion and your drive also towards equestrian welfare. And I hope I can keep that level until I'm in your age and you are still going strong. That's really, really impressive.
Thank you.
So let's have a little retrospective and talk a little bit about the start of your career. What was it that set the spark in you?
Well, I've always been a rider since I was a very small child. So I was one of those girls with a passion for horses. And I was very much a competitive rider. I always wanted to start with young horses, improve them, compete with them, and see them develop. And I learned quite early on that you needed to understand horses and that lameness was the most common reason that they couldn't work. So I was not really sure what I wanted to do with my career. And then I suddenly decided late on in my school days that I wanted to be an equine vet. So I went to vet school purely with the idea of being an equine veterinarian. And pretty soon after that, I just wanted to be really involved with poor performance and lameness, because those were the most things that were relevant to my experience as a horse rider. And it kind of evolved from there. And I was very fortunate to work with a lot of good riders and coaches when I was riding. And I got exposed to all sorts of different people. I was also mentored by a number of very good equine veterinarians. So I kind of learned by osmosis, and that kind of fired my passion to want to learn more and always to ask why. Why? Can we believe this? And if not, why not? What do we need to find out next? So it was never just a matter of just being an equine veterinarian and merely looking at horses and treating them. I was always asking questions. And then I became really frustrated by the fact that I realized that lots of people didn't recognize that their training related problems were actually because the horses had underlying discomfort. So, could there be a way of improving people's recognition of discomfort? Because clearly they did not recognize lameness. And it was so frustrating as a veterinarian, because you would be presented with a horse and you would go into the history and you would realize that this horse had had a problem ever since they bought the horse 9 months previously. So, they probably bought the horse with a problem and they didn't recognize that. And the veterinarian that had done the pre-purchase examination hadn't recognized that. So clearly there were problems across the board. There was problems with riders and trainers not recognizing the presence of pain-related gait abnormalities. And there were also problems with the veterinary profession not recognizing this. So we needed to do something about this, because the longer a horse has had a problem, the more difficult it is to resolve those problems, because they develop secondary compensatory gait patterns. They stiffen the back, and as a result of stiffening the back, they don't develop the muscles properly of the top line, or they reduce the amount of muscle mass they have, and then they change their posture, and then you get myofascial tension, and it's a downward spiral thereon. So the earlier you can recognize a problem and intervene, the more likely we are to have long-term resolution of the problem and make the horse a happier athlete with a longer athletic career, which has to be surely what we want to do. And I've also recognized that I've had the good fortune to ride horses from low level to upper national level, and I know what a normal horse should feel like. I think there are quite a lot of people who ride horses regularly who've never had the opportunity to ride an absolutely normal horse. So they don't actually recognize what a normal horse should feel like. And trainers get so accustomed to watching horses which have got problems, their view of normality is not of what real normality is. And the trainer has been trained to improve the horse's way of going by various techniques and to improve the rider's position and their skill level. But they rarely say, I wonder why this horse is not improving. Could it be because there is underlying discomfort? And I've recognized working with lots of horses from low level to high level that if I can manage their discomfort appropriately, then everybody's happier. The horse is happier, the rider's happier, they're more successful, the horse is more trainable, the horse is safer. It's a win-win situation for everybody.
Still, it appears like some people nearly feel assaulted when I'm as a trainer going there and say, I think that looks difficult. I would like actually to get professional advice on that. I don't feel comfortable with training that. I often get this reaction that people are really feeling assaulted, and that is, I don't understand that reaction. It's a little bit sad. Maybe it's human.
Yeah, I think it's into psychology, and people are naturally defensive and they don't want to feel that their horse and their management of the horse is being criticized. But it's not really a criticism of their management. It's just kind of saying you need to open your eyes and ask why.
And you have said something very important, and that is you can only recognize the abnormality if you have once seen normal. And there, I would really like to pick your brain, because do you feel that became more difficult over the years? So, do we have a problem in breeding? Are we breeding less healthy horses, or has it always been like this? And are we now just smarter and see more?
I think our breeding programs have changed, certainly when you think about elite competition horses, because we need horses with more athleticism, either as dressage horses or as show jumpers or even as event horses, because the standards have gone up and up and up. But I don't think that at the lower levels things have changed very much. What has changed at the lower levels, I think, certainly in the UK, is the way in which horses are being kept and on the circumstances under which they're ridden. So when I was a child, I would ride on the village green and practice my dressage on the village green. I would go out into the forest and jump whatever I found. I would ride to the Pony Club rally along the road. The pony would go back for an hour to the Pony Club rally. We would be engaged all day doing stuff, and I would ride back again. So the ponies and horses got much more variety in their work, and they were ridden on different terrains rather than going in an arena day after day after day and going round and round and round in circles, which I don't think is good for a horse either mentally or physically. So I think that there are things that have changed in the way that we are managing horses, as well as the way in which we are breeding the upper level elite horses. And then I think that there are riders, particularly those who want to do dressage, who aspire to do better. So they buy horses that perhaps are too much for them. And then they have to practice defensive riding because they otherwise, the horse is too exuberant for them. So then they restrict the horse's movement. And then the horse doesn't really understand. So the horse reacts by just kind of saying, okay, I'll submit. And that's not good for them physically or mentally either.
No, yeah, interesting. Interesting observation. We often also see that the horses are, in German we say, stehen sich tot oder werden so tot geschont. So they are not moved at all. They are just in the backyard and are standing at the hay feeder. And they're also not getting out there from that. Now I'm getting a bit carried away here. If I'm going back to my original line of thought, we can also see that the veterinarian diagnostics has changed impressively over the recent decades. I mean, At the start, it was difficult to get somebody out there with an X-ray, and now we have mobile X-rays, we have an MRI, we have CT, we have unbelievable, fantastic methods. What is the influence of modern diagnostics, and is that more important than a trained eye?
I think the most important thing is a good clinical evaluation and selection of the most appropriate diagnostic tools to use, and then correct interpretation of the tools that you've used, and then putting together a picture that should fit together like a jigsaw. And if it doesn't fit together appropriately, then you have to go back to the clinical examination because that's the most important thing. I think that people have tended to become more reliant on diagnostic tools and forget to look at the horse and to look at the whole horse. And to me, having started in an era when we had X-rays, but we didn't have ultrasonography, certainly didn't have MRI or CT, things have evaluated hugely. And I have become a better clinician because I've used those tools to help me, but I've not been reliant on those tools. I've used objective gait analysis, but I've also questioned how reliable is this? Does it really help me? Do I need to go back and look more at the horse? And I think that the really important thing is that we don't place over-reliance on those tools. We keep coming back to ask, what is the horse's problem? And are we investigating in the most appropriate way? And when we're talking about lameness and poor performance, the keys are determining the sources of pain, which we normally have to do by the clinical examination and the use of nerve blocks, and then using the most appropriate imaging technique to tell us what is causing that pain. And then thinking, how do I best manage that pain? What am I going to do? And what other members of the horse's management team are we going to need to help us? Because it's not just the veterinarian that's going to do the management. We're going to need help from the farrier, the saddle fitter, the manual therapist. We're all a group together, I think.
It's a very multidisciplinary approach.
I think it's essential if you want to do the best for the horse and the rider. And sometimes we need the physiotherapist for the rider to improve their posture and position. And maybe they need to be going to the gym so that they get fitter and develop a better core muscle strength. And I think that's something that riders don't take responsibility enough for their own physical fitness and their own position and the influence that is going to have on the horse's ability to move correctly.
Yeah, and often it's also a bit like unwrapping an onion, I feel, layer by
Yeah.
layer, you take something off and then you think, ah, this is interesting. And then you're coming home with the horse, and after 2 weeks, you think, that wasn't it. We need more research here. That can be sometimes like a real crime show, a little bit like a thriller.
So I think it's really exciting that we've got things like CT because we're learning even now. I'm involved in a study in Hungary when we're looking at CT and comparing with MRI. But there are lots of unanswered questions too. Just because you find something on an image doesn't necessarily mean it's causing pain, and it may be completely irrelevant to the clinical picture.
And horses can have lice and feet. That's a
Yes.
German. That's a German proverb. Germany works very beautiful. There we are saying, "Wir können Läuse und Flöhe gleichzeitig haben." You can have two different things at the same time that might be related or not.
Yes.
And that is leading up to the very impressive amount of studies that you have led during your clinical career. And you often, and that is what I really like about your research, you very often have a very practical approach to things. So for us trainers, this knowledge is easy to use. I am thinking, I have in the back of my mind, for example, your saddle slipping study, where I, as a trainer, have learned for many, many years how to correct the rider, and then we find out, okay, a slipping saddle has actually something to do with the pain in the horse and less with the posture of the rider. That was very eye-opening for me. But what were your personal highlights or milestones? What did you like best?
I think that there have been so many because I started by looking at the use of nerve blocks because I feel that that's so important from a diagnostic perspective. But then we moved on to looking at more about the horse rider saddle interaction, which is how we got involved with saddle slip. And then from there, we moved on to pain recognition because of my frustration with people not recognizing lameness. So it's very difficult to pick out a single thing because I've been so lucky that I've been involved in project after project, and I can keep asking, what's next? Why?
That is fantastic that you kept this curiosity of still saying, why? Why is it like this? Why? And that is leading us directly to the Ridden Pain Ethogram, what was definitely or is one of the keys to more equine welfare. And what I feel is so fantastic about the Ridden Pain Ethogram, and it was published in 2018, is, I mean, there's so many pain ethograms out there when we are looking at research, but you have been narrowing it down to 24 behaviors. And there are 24 behaviors that are traditionally considered to be trainability issues. And that is what makes it, in my eyes, so genius and so practical to apply, because we can suddenly say that if the horse is not keeping the gate, we have proof of that this might be a pain behavior and is not a training issue. I am pretty sure, knowing you a little bit, this was not an accident that you picked out trainability or things that were traditionally considered to be trainability issues. And I'm also wondering, when we are looking at classical dressage, and now I'm not only looking at the sports, but I'm also looking at classical riding schools like what I am involved in, we are considering in our mindset very often that when a hindfoot is falling out or like is stepping short, the horse needs to be strengthened and we need to put more weight on that leg. And now we are having a pain ethogram, and that pain ethogram is saying, no, we can't put more weight on that leg. It's exactly the opposite way around. And I feel that for me as a trainer, that is turning the whole world upside down. But now I'm getting a little bit carried away. So what I actually wanted to ask you is, how did you come up with the 24 behaviors? How did you
Well,
choose them?
we took a group of comfortably working horses that were in regular work that in which we could not identify any gait abnormalities. So those were our control horses. And then we took a group of lame horses. And this was after we had looked at videos of hundreds of horses and developed a list of 117 behaviours, each of which had strict definitions. So we then applied these 117 behaviors to our group of control horses and the lame horses and identified those behaviors that were seen much more frequently in the lame horses versus the control horses. So most of the 24 behaviors were at least 10 times more likely to be seen in a lame horse versus a non-lame horse. And we established that the majority of non-lame horses score between 0 and 4 out of 24, but the majority of lame horses score 8 or more out of 24. There is some overlap, however. You can have a lame horse which scores less than 8 out of 24, but if it scores 8 or more out of 24, it is very highly likely that the horse has got musculoskeletal pain. And that is different with a horse that doesn't understand what to do with a movement, or you're training it and there's a problem with progression. Those horses may show several abnormal behaviors, but they do not show 8 or more. So we can differentiate between those horses which have underlying pain and those which do not. And it's really important to recognize it is the total score out of 24 that's important. So the horse may be swishing its tail repeatedly, which is one of the 24 behaviors. But if that was the only behavior it showed, there probably are another other explanations. The horse may be being stuck in the ribs by a spur continually, and it's responding to that rib cue, that spur cue, and that's making it swish its tail. Or it may be plagued by flies. So we have to remember that for each of the individual 24 behaviors, There may be more than one reason, and we mustn't get fixated by one specific or two specific behaviors. We have to say, to be indicative of pain, we have to be identifying eight or more of the 24 behaviors. But you've got a small proportion of horses which are lame, which score less than eight, and that will depend on the degree of discomfort, the duration of that discomfort, the work intensity, the pain threshold of the horse. So there are a number of influential factors, and whether or not the saddle fits, because if the saddle doesn't fit, that's going to contribute to discomfort.
It's also pain, just a different one, not
Yes.
muscles. Yeah, exactly. I also feel that it's very nice that you have explained that now so clearly again, because I often see there's many questions around the 24 behaviors when I'm suggesting it to usage for a student, also for scouring their own horse and for seeing is there something going on or is this really a training issue? Many people believe that the 24 behaviors are simply due to bad riding or bad riding technique, a bad leg, too much spur. So when they are a good rider, that can in any way is not relevant to them.
I don't think that's the case. I think a good rider can improve gait quality. So they can improve the quality of the trot and the canter and the transitions, but they cannot disguise the behaviors which reflect discomfort. And we did a study in which we looked at 40 horses which were ridden by the normal rider and by a single professional rider. And the professional rider, if they were better skill-wise than the normal rider, they could make the horse go better. But if the horse had underlying discomfort, they couldn't disguise the behaviors reflecting pain. The behaviors reflecting pain could change. So, for example, you could take a horse which was ridden by the normal rider and it went with its head in front of a vertical position more than 30 degrees most of the time, so it was above the bit. The skilled professional rider would encourage the horse to work with its head in a vertical position. The horse actually found this not very comfortable because it had underlying pain, and therefore it would start swishing its tail. So the behaviors changed, but the total on average did not change. So the skilled rider can superficially make the horse move better, but they can't disguise the signs of discomfort.
Just change.
Unless they just ride as a passenger. If they rode just as a passenger and didn't ask anything of the horse, then that may be a little bit different. But
From there, we are kind of naturally evolving to the recent events in the industry and in dressage, and of course, the Olympics in Paris. It's a very hot topic out there right now, and there I just have to ask again, as you have been there seeing it, was everything better in the past? So have we just had better riders in the past, and this is what we have to fix, and that's it?
Well, I was fortunate enough to go to Versailles and saw the 3-day event live. And I watched everything else, every single dressage test and every single show jumping round on Discovery TV. So I saw everything and I made lots of notes about what I was observing when I was seeing it live and when I was watching it on screen. And I would say that if I think about what I saw, for example, at the World Championships in 1992 in Stockholm, which I was at, and I saw every competition then, I would say the overall picture is better. It's different, but it's better. I can remember in the dressage at Stockholm thinking, well, I loved Rembrandt with Nicola Uphoff, and there was Granat as well with Christine Stoppelberger. So they were the top two. And after that, I kept thinking, these look horrible, absolutely horrible. They're being pulled around and they look uncomfortable. And I would not say it was the same at the Olympics in the pure dressage. But I could say there was an incredibly high incidence of head behind the vertical, repeated mouth opening with separation of the teeth, and repeated tail swishing. And those three things were seen time and time and time again. And that very much mirrors work that we've done previously on horses competing at Grand Prix, World Cup qualifiers and championships, and also sub-elite Grand Prix level. And I think that this reflects largely the way in which these horses are being trained and the way in which they are being rewarded for how they're moving. The judges, I think, don't necessarily observe or penalize repeated mouth opening. Whereas if you look at the guidelines for dressage judging, repeated mouth opening should be marked down in every movement in which it's seen. And I cannot think that it is when you look at the marks that are being given for each of the specific movements. And it's probably, and I need to go back and do the figures, but I think it's probably about 85% of the horses showed repeated mouth opening in the Grand Prix dressage, both in the Grand Prix special, and in the freestyle. And you see that mouth opening much more in the dressage horses than you do in the 3-day event horses. In the 3-day event horses,
Interesting.
well, I think there are a number of reasons. I think one, the dressage horses are using double bridles. Their movements are more difficult biomechanically for the horse, and the riders have got stronger hand cues. And you'll quite often see the rider's hands moving in rhythm with the trot, and often the mouth opening is to an extent in rhythm with those hand cues. So I think that there are a number of different reasons. But in the 3-day event dressage phase, you see horse after horse which has got a stiff, stilted canter, or a canter lacking hind limb impulsion and engagement, or difficulties with the flying changes. Whereas when those horses are out on cross country, they canter fine or gallop fine. When they're show jumping, they canter fine. So then one's asking, well, does this reflect the way they're being trained? Or maybe they also have some degree of discomfort, so they're struggling in the canter when they're within the confines of the dressage arena. But the very best in the 3-day event dressage were wonderful. The bottom end were not so wonderful. So there was definitely a pattern which was different between the 3-day event horses doing dressage and pure dressage horses doing dressage. If we were to think about their ethogram scores, most of them would score pretty low despite that. So that's a good thing. One other observation I would make about the 3-day event is that during the dressage phase, there were 17% of the horses that showed some degree of lameness during the test. Not necessarily all the time, but some of the time. And of those 17%, only one finished in the top 25, which I think shows how discomfort can influence overall performance, which is what we've shown before, because we've shown that at 5-star 3-day events, horses scoring 7 or more out of 24 on the ethogram during warm-up do less well. They're more than twice as likely not to finish cross-country because they've either been eliminated or retired. So we know that there is a relationship between discomfort and quality of performance. We've shown the same thing in Grand Prix dressage. Those horses that have the lowest ridden horse pain ethogram scores have the highest good marks awarded by the judges. So there is a relationship between discomfort and performance. The other observation from a show jumping perspective was that at Tokyo, which I saw on the television, not live, in the pure show jumping, I was very much disturbed by the amount of pulling and kicking and horses fighting, 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 wanting to go faster to fences. And I saw much less of that in the pure show jumping this time. What was interesting was the number of horses that bucked and kicked out, either on landing or over the fence, they would kick out backwards, which I think is a reflection of lumbosacroiliac joint region pain. And those horses, by and large, there's a notable exception, did less well than those horses that didn't buck and kick out. But one notable exception was the actual individual winner of the gold medal, who in the preliminary round bucked and kicked out repeatedly and did so in the team competition, but didn't do it at all in the individual competition. So somebody treated that horse rather well, I think, because it was so different in the individual competition. So to me, it was a fascinating set of competitions. I was sad that the horse inspections and the warm-up area were totally forbidden territory for spectators. And I would like to see openness and transparency so we can see what's going on and so we can understand what's going on better. And it would also have been nice to see horses working in the arena during the familiarization periods, but that as well was not allowed. And that to me is a bit of a shame. But in saying that, it was a fabulous venue and it seemed to go really, really well. There's obviously been subsequent controversy about alleged blue tongues in the dressage, some of the dressage horses, with some of the riders having been given oral warnings after the competition. I've never seen in life a horse with a blue tongue, so I don't know how real this is. I've seen photographs of horses with blue tongues, but they've also had blue lips and blue gums as well. And that makes no physiological sense to me. I don't think we know enough about this. And I worry that various people are creating problems and they're taking photographs. And I think it's really dangerous to make any judgments about single frame photographs, because we need to see these horses in action and we need to make sure that these photographs have not been doctored in any way to alter colours. So I'm disturbed if we are having blue tongues genuinely, which probably must reflect some disruption of either arterial blood supply or venous flow from your tongue. But I think we don't know enough about it. And we don't know actually to what extent it's happening or not happening. There's obviously the controversy that coincided with the Olympics about Charlotte Dujardin. And I think that that's a very sad situation for the entire equine industry. I think that Charlotte was wrong to do what she did. And I suspect it's happened more than once. And it's appropriate that she was suspended, and we'll have to see what the outcome is. But I think we need, within the equestrian industry, to be open and transparent, because I know there are all sorts of things happening that really shouldn't be happening. These are not single episode events. And I think we need to be opening up and saying, we have done wrong, and this is what we've been doing wrong, and this is what we're going to do to address this and improve things, and what we can do to proactively show the people within the equine world that are against competition, against bits, against shoes, against jumping horses, of which they're quite a vociferous number, and also in the global world of the general public, we have to show that we have done wrong and we are going to do better. But we also can deliver good news, because the work that we've done with the ethogram shows that at upper level competition, the majority of the horses score between 0 and 4. So the majority of the horses are comfortable athletes. And it's actually at the lower levels that we see a higher proportion of uncomfortable horses. So we applied the ethogram to low-level event horses competing over fences at 90 and 100 centimeters and 1 meter 10, and we saw a bigger spectrum of scores from 0 to 6 was the mean, with the maximum score being 12 out of 24, and that is of concern. So I think we actually have more potential welfare problems at the bottom end than we do at the top end, and I think we need to be addressing this and being, as I say, open and transparent about what is going wrong and how we can improve things. And one way we can improve things is making people more aware of what normal should look like and feel like.
That is a lot of information. Let's try to frame this. I'm trying to frame that now a little bit because there's so much valuable information in what you just said. So the good news is that in most of the horses, we can see a much higher level of comfort than you did a few years ago. And that is fantastic.
Yes.
That is really fantastic. Then you have been shortly addressing the blue tongue issue. And what, as a veterinarian, what is your explanation for a blue tongue? If a horse has a blue tongue, how can that happen? Is it too much pressure from the hand? Is it that they don't get enough air? How can that happen at all?
We just don't know. We just don't know. There has been some work done in Australia when they looked at the practice of the use of a tongue tie. So that is forcefully tying the tongue down to the lower palate, to the lower jaw. So they do
I
that
see
with
that
a.
from, I know that from the racing industry, right? Yes.
So they have looked at the way that that can influence the blood supply to the tongue, and that can jeopardize the arterial blood supply to the tongue. But that's not necessarily the same as what's happening if it is happening with blue tongue in dressage horses. And I don't know, because I've never seen it, if this is actually happening and what are the mechanisms. Is it related to the horse's head and neck posture? Is it related to pressure on the tongue by the bits of the double bridle? Are they becoming starved of air? Is the blood supply being compromised? I don't think we know. We really don't know. And I've been watching my dogs running. And last week I took a photograph of one of my spaniels, and the back of its tongue was blue after it had been running for some time. Now I can tell you there was no bit or bridle in my dog. It was running loose. But very temporarily, the back of its tongue was definitely blue. But as it stood and panted, it very quickly became pink again. Now, I haven't recognized this on any sort of regular basis because I wasn't looking. But I've been intrigued by this because, as I say, I have never seen a horse with a blue tongue, and I've watched lots of horses warm up for Grand Prix dressage. So I really genuinely do not know if it occurs, and if it occurs, how frequently it occurs, and whether it's something we should really be worried about. Personally, I think there are more important things to be worried about rather than blue tongue, because I think it by the very fact that I haven't seen it probably means it's relatively rare and is not of the, in the general scheme of things, an enormous problem.
Let's say it's an area for future research.
Yes, but it's very difficult. I mean, ethically, what can you do? Can you take a horse and make it
Make the
do
blue tongue
blue?
blue.
I mean that's unethical to me, particularly when I don't perceive it as a major problem.
Yeah, I understand. Then, of course, we have the Charlotte Dujardin issue, and I agree with you. It appears to not be a single case, but I also. For me personally, it feels wrong that one person is now, hung up there, out there for canceling culture and everything. I don't want to have anything to do. I also feel this would be a great moment now with all the research we have today and everything. I mean, we see also not only lameness and pain research, but also in behaviorism, an increase of studies that we have. We know so much better. I feel that this is the moment in the industry where we can say, wow, we have learned so much more. Let's apply it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think if you look at not only the Charlotte Dujardin video, but the Corina Kruth video and the
Oh God,
health
I don't
span
want to even
videos,
know. I don't know them all.
it's going on repeatedly. But we have to say, we know from a learning point of view that a horse under stress cannot learn.
Cannot learn.
And that's a really important point to put across to people. that whatever you're doing, that is not going to be a productive learning experience for the horse. You might be making it do something, but it's not the correct way for a horse to learn. And in fact, many horses will just become so confused and anxious and stressed that you are doing absolutely everything wrong by forcing it in the ways that we've seen.
And we also have to say that this or these practices are often, even if they aren't done well, but very often we have this idea as trainers that we need to make the horse do things for making it better, for making it move better, for making it feel better, for making it healthy. I have a lot of people who still think that if we are training hard enough, if we are training well enough, the horse will come out healthy. But if we are applying pain ethograms like the 24 behaviors or others, we are figuring out that this has nothing to do with trainability. We need to frame it from a different perspective. And then the harsh training method isn't needed anymore.
And I think there is has been a move to develop these big moving horses and then to produce them in young horse classes, which encourages too rapid a progression in the training and encourages the horses to be worked in a way that does not facilitate the development of the right muscle groups being used in the right way, so that we are potentially creating a situation which is going to predispose to the development of pain-related problems. So I think that the recent move from the Gothenburg show to take away the young horse classes is a good move. Because I see so many problems that are directly related to overproduction of young horses. I realize that there are commercial pressures by breeders and young horse trainers because they want to sell these horses, and the young horse classes are a show window for them. And high performance sales are a pressure to overproduce horses too quickly. But I really think we need to step back and say, well, we need to promote sports horse longevity. And to do that, we need to take the horses more slowly. And whatever their natural expressiveness must be, maybe, we need to say the horse must be moving in the correct frame, appropriate for its level of training, so that it can develop the muscles of the thoracic girdle, the top line muscles of the neck, of the back, and properly engage the hind limbs rather than the rather forced high neck posture, extravagant fall in movement, which makes the back extend, which makes it more difficult for the horses to step under from behind. So for me, that principle of the slower development of the horse in the correct frame is far, by far, one of the most important things that we need to address.
Yeah, and what you also said in the start, a horse needs a varying training schedule and then hike out in the countryside and be exposed to things and not only go round. Round, another round. Have you ever seen the sketch? I think it was from Philip Carl, where the dressage horse is lying on the sofa and saying, and then he makes me go round and round. Always have that in the back of my mind. That was fantastic. Very spot on. We have one last thing that I have totally forgotten now that you had in your lineup, and I said okay, and this we need to that we need to mention too. Should have made a note. You had such a long list with very important arguments there that I wanted to address. It's in the back of my mind somewhere. I'm pretty sure I need to ask you that next time. The good news is, so we are moving forward. And the good news, now I know it was the bottom layer. Because this is also what I'm experiencing. I'm not very much looking at what happens at the Olympic Games and everything else anyway, because I think it's such a small group. The bottom group is so much higher, and I also experience where that we have a lot of people who are very much wanting to do better for their horse, but don't know how to. And then we have not only training issues, but we also host these possible these issues with obesity, for example. We have the issues with gastric ulcer. We have the issues with not simply not enough movement, just not getting outside time enough, not being socialized, and everything that goes around there. And I would really, really wish that we are not always standing there and saying these people up there, but that we are having a look at our own, yeah, backyard and see what kind of horse do I have there and what does it need. And when you are looking at it from your perspective as a pain researcher, and you are now saying, wow, I see more horses on bottom levels that are scoring high, that is, of course, worrisome. So, what can we do at bottom levels for increasing equine welfare and training?
I think it's a matter of education. And that means that the trainers and coaches have got to be in a position that they recognize discomfort and that they can communicate with the owners. And we've already touched on the difficulty of the psychology of the owner and how do we lead the owner in the right direction. I think that they have to accept an onus of responsibility. That if you are a horse rider, you have responsibility for your horse and you have the responsibility for your horse's welfare. So it is important that you, as a rider, make sure that your saddle fits not only the horse, but you as well. And it's better to pay for a regular saddle fit check than it is to buy another pair of matching boots, which the horse probably doesn't need. And it's persuading owners to spend their money in the most appropriate way, I think. And making them realize that their horse will be more comfortable for them to ride if the horse is comfortable. So if the rider is complaining that each time they ride the horse, they get backache, they need to be asking, well, why do I get backache? And maybe it's because the horse's back has become stiff because it has some other problem and it's reacting to try and disguise its pain because it's a prey animal. So it's got to stay looking okay. And what it does is it stiffens its back. And therefore, it's more impulse going up through your back. And that's why you're getting backache. So it's a trickle feed education process. And I'm not suggesting it's easy because I know it's not. I saw somebody riding down my road yesterday and the saddle was slipping way off to the right-hand side and they had no idea what was going on. And this was only a walk. But I was just thinking, looking and thinking, wow, she's quite big, a big rider. And she's sitting on the back of the saddle as well. So the whole weight distribution for the horse is wrong. But she's completely unaware of this. And there is technology available now that you can buy through apps to monitor your position, which is helpful. And people seem to like technology. But one of the problems is what media do we use to educate people by? And how do we grab people's attention? And that's something that I don't think I know enough about. What are the best tools to try and educate people in today's society when it seems that the attention span is like 5 minutes maximum? And you don't want to bowl people over with too much information because too much information is information overload. So we just have to drip feed slowly, but we have to have a consistent message and we have to make people across the board recognize that everybody's looking at the equine industry, and it would be more helpful if the equine industry itself was more unified, because at the moment we're not unified at all, because we've got a group who don't want us, as I said before, to use bits or jump horses or shoe horses without thinking about all the other consequences of not using bits. Because if you're using a bit and they're using a hackamore, then there's excessive pressure on the nose. Not all horses are suitable to go barefoot. And there are some horses that jump, and they, I think, genuinely enjoy jumping, and they get more mental stimulation from their lives by jumping. But we need to come together if we can.
That is a very, very nice perspective for the future. I really would like that. And that is also what we are working for at Equidemia. We would like to give owners informed decisions or the possibility to take informed decisions. And I am very grateful that we have speakers like you who are helping us to educate trainers and therapists for then going out to the customer and saying, hey, let's have a look at that. And then we walk through this process hand in hand and are trying the best for the horse in the end. So that is my wish for the future. More multidisciplinary approach, and that we don't see each other as enemies, but that we can, yeah, cooperate and work together, and that we don't think one discipline is better than the other, but that we are all unifying for the sake of the horse.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for this morning, Sue.
You're very welcome. A pleasure.
It's a pleasure talking to you each time, and very enlightening, and looking forward to next time. Thank you very much.